Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome on this very gray Seattle day today. But not to worry, we have three great guests joining us today. We have a jam-packed show. But first, I want to kick off by asking you, do you think size matters? Well, my second guest says, when it comes to the size of our economic growth, the speed and scale at which we're growing is creating far more problems than we know. He questions why we're never satisfied, why we always want more, why we link growth with prosperity, because he says studies show the two do not go hand in hand. He has a big call to action for us, and we'll hear more on that from Dave Gardner, producer, director, writer of the documentary Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth, in about 20 minutes. We'll end today's show with Rivina Sharma, who says when she got married, her mother handed her a book of handwritten recipes, but no one gave her the recipe for a good marriage or a good life. She'll share stories from her new book, Recipes for a Sacred Life, true tales that connect us more deeply with love, joy, and purpose. But first, I'm very pleased to have Sharon Creech on the phone with us. She is a Newbery and Carnegie Medal winner and national best-selling author. Her latest book is The Boy on the Porch, and it's a beautiful novel about finding love in surprising places. Sharon Creech, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And you have written something like 16 books, I believe. Is that right?
19.
19. Okay. I was counting up in the back of the book here. I figured you'd probably got a couple more lying around somewhere. So this book is called The Boy on the Porch, and it is an unusual story. I've not read anything like it before. It's a quick read. I sat down and I had what I tell listeners, a mini vacation while I read your book.
Oh, nice. So I hope it was a happy vacation.
It was a happy vacation. So tell us a little bit about the book in your own words, if you would.
Well, The Boy on the Porch is it's a gentle story of a young boy and of a young couple who find this boy asleep on their porch one morning. And they live out in the country. It's probably set 40, 50 years ago, pre-Amber Alert. So it would not be necessarily so unusual to find a stranger on your porch. It would not be so unusual for a young boy perhaps to have strayed. But what they discover is this boy doesn't speak, but he has a note in his pocket that he eventually shows them, and it says, "Please take care of Jacob. He's a good boy. We'll be back when we can." And they have no idea who might have written this note, who the boy is, where he came from, but they're willing to let him be there for the day or whatever and see what happens. But no one comes for the boy that day or that evening or the next day or the next day. And days and weeks go on, and it becomes more and more of a puzzle. And the longer he's there, the more attached they become to him, and the more he seems to be thriving in their care. And so the question becomes, you know, who is this boy? Why is he there? What's going to happen? Is someone going to reclaim him? And that's the big question of the book.
Yeah, and he's an unusual kind of child, and I have to confess, I fell in love with him too. Where did you get the idea for this? Where did that germ of an idea start for you?
You know, I don't always know, but I think what I can best surmise is I had read an article in the New Yorker maybe 6 months or a year earlier. I think it was the New Yorker, and it was about children who were abandoned in parks, I think, in China. I have no real good recollection of this article. But I remember being profoundly concerned that, at first thinking, well, who could do such a thing? Who could just leave their child in a park, you know, not knowing who might claim the child? And then my attention switched to the child. Well, might the child be better off, or might the child be worse off, or you know, how would you know, and what would happen? And so many, many days went by with me concerned with this. And I think that then 6 months later, it just kind of started bubbling up in my head, because I woke 3 mornings in a row. I woke with this phrase in my head, the boy on the porch.
Oh, wow.
And it just very strongly, just that sentence, that phrase, nothing more, the boy on the porch. And so I, without remembering the New Yorker article, I thought, well, this is something that wants telling. You know, there's a story here, and I better write to find out who the boy on the porch is and why he's there.
That's so interesting. It's funny how things stay with us and then suddenly come in a bubble like that, isn't it?
Yes.
So I'm always interested in how people got, regardless of what they do, how they got to where they are today. And I loved reading on your website that when you were young, you wanted to be many things, a painter, an ice skater, a singer, a teacher, a reporter. And you said, but it soon became apparent you had no talent, no drawing talent, limited tolerance for falling on ice, and you weren't any good as a reporter because you didn't like facts. So you go into teaching, as I understand it, and you taught in London and Switzerland. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I taught at an American school in England and in Switzerland, and I taught upper school English. I had gone over, I was recently divorced, I had 2 young children, and I needed a change of everything.
Right.
And so I took this job, at first at the American school in England, and it was just life-changing for me. It just opened up so many parts of my soul, I think, and I loved the teaching there. It was a private school, but we had great latitude in how we taught our courses. There were a lot of explorations where you'd take your class to Westminster Abbey or up to Stratford-on-Avon or, you know, all over the place. And so I loved teaching and taught for 15 years. I 3 years after I was there, I married the man who became the headmaster of the sister school in Switzerland. We lived there for a couple of years, and then we moved back to England for another 14 years.
Wow.
So after 15 years of teaching, I was teaching you know, Shakespeare, Chaucer, Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. Hemingway, great stories all. And I think my head was just so full of these great stories I'd always wanted to write. And I think there just came a point shortly after my father died when I realized, you know, if I'm going to do this, I better do it now. And the stories just started to come out, and out they came. And I first wrote thinking I was going to be, you know, like a F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, very literary. And I wrote about grown-ups, two books that came out there in England. And then I wrote a children's book. I didn't know it was a children's book. It was my agent who said, you know, if you're writing about a 12-year-old narrator, let's check with the children's publishers on this. And they asked for that and one more. And the one more was a book called Walk to Moons. It was the first one of my books to come out in the States. And it, to everyone's surprise, not least of all my own, it received the Newbery Medal. So that was a sort of game changer. It was sort of opened a lot of doors. It gave me an audience. It gave me sort of license to continue to do what I was discovering was my next love. Teaching was my first love, and then mm-hmm. along came writing. And I'm very fortunate to be able to have done those two things that I really love to do.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, as I listen to you talk, and I know I read in several articles that you were very surprised when you won the Newbery Medal. Another of your books was received an honors award. But I'm wondering, yes, it opened up doors for you, but how did it change you and the way you saw yourself as a writer?
Sorry, could you repeat that? There's a little interference on my line.
Sure. How did it make you feel as a writer after you'd won the Newbery Medal? Did it change the way you saw yourself?
Well, it did. I kept writing as I was writing, but what it did was gave me a sense of great validation, because I was at the point where I'd written these 2 adult novels, I'd written Walk to Moons, but didn't even know if anyone had read it, and I was at the point where I thought, you know, I need to go back to teaching full-time. My children were about to enter college, you know, I thought extra income would be good. And I was really, really on the cusp of, do I continue this or is it just a luxury? And what the Newbery Medal did was validate, well, what you're doing is good.
Right.
And people, there's an audience for it. And yet it sort of was like someone saying, yes, you should continue to do this. And so I just felt this tremendous freedom, too, that, okay, it had been difficult writing that book that won the Newbery Award, but I had learned a lot during the process, and I had trusted my instincts all along the way. So if that was working, I could continue to do that. And I just felt, okay, I've worked hard, and it worked.
Right, right. I ask a lot of writers which is their favorite book, and most come back with the answer, I can't really choose, or it's the latest one. What's your answer to that?
Well, pretty much that. the latest one, The Boy in the Porch, is a favorite because it's the new baby. So you're cautious about it entering the world. You hope that people treat it gently. You hope that people love it as you do, that, you know, you put your heart and soul into it, and it's sort of the culmination of everything you've done before. So in that way, you know, it's a favorite. But having said that, each is a favorite for different reasons. I can name one that, aside from Walk Two Moons, which won the Newbery Medal and has been translated into 25 languages, another book that receives a whole lot of love is a book called Love That Dog. And Love That Dog was just a big surprise to me. It just kind of came out one day, just sort of emerged as this story of a young boy who finds his voice through poetry, even though he hates poetry, but he has a great teacher. And it's a very simple story, very short novel, but it struck a chord with so many students and so many adults who had struggled in school with poetry or with writing or whatever. And so that book, because I received such warm and wonderful letters, you know, from people whose sense of self has been changed by that book is special for that other reason. But I could, you know, if you named any one of my other books, I could tell you exactly why it was special to me.
How hard is it, or is it hard for you to go from adult to children's books and back? You know, some people struggle with that, and others find it quite easy.
Well, you know, I've only wrote the first two adult books
right
in the beginning, and then I haven't written one since because I found that I had maybe a more natural sensibility of a 12-year-old, which I don't mean to make it sound, you know, like I'm ignorant or stupid, but or immature. It was probably a better word. It's just that there's so much fun there, and there's so much to explore. I mean, it seems to me that it's easier for me to be humorous if I'm writing about a young person, but also to be able to tackle issues that interest me or serious issues. So there's a serious story and wrapped around it is humor. And that seems to suit me very well. I have really no desire to go back to writing, you know, stories about adults because, to be quite honest, I think right now they interest me less than children. Now I meet so many children, and I think it fits well with my love of teaching is that I just love the minds of young people who, you know, minds that are still open to so much and, you know, they could become anything and yet they're so welcoming to new ideas and new experiences. There's just a vibrancy there that attracts me, I suppose.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I think some of my greatest learning of experiences have been from children.
Yeah.
and watching how
they... There are so many great writers out there now,
yeah,
too, who are writing. There's so much great stuff.
Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily call this a children's book. I mean, I read it cover to cover, and I enjoyed the story.
Oh, good. I'm glad you did. But I've heard that, you know, initially I was a little worried, well, because so much is about the adult point of view in the book, you know, what they're thinking as they they enter the life of this child.
Right.
I thought, you know, our reviewers are probably going to say, oh, children won't identify. But in fact, children have vastly and quickly identified. I've Skyped with a couple of schools in the past week, and what is just so great is they'll say things like, wow, I never knew parents didn't automatically know how to raise kids. Because, you know, the couple in this book kind of struggles. Like, what do we do now?
I know.
And kids are like, really? They don't know, you know, how to teach you to read, or they don't know how to how to teach you to do chores. Or it was just, it's just priceless.
And maybe that's doing good in the world, Sharon. Maybe kids are going to be kinder to their parents after they read your
Maybe. I have to ask you, so your accent is English?
English, yes.
Yeah, so where are you from?
From Birmingham.
So
where did you live when you were in England?
We lived in Surrey, about 18 miles southwest of London, near in a little village called Thorpe.
Okay.
Not too far from Windsor.
Okay, oh, lovely. I love Windsor. Yeah, beautiful. So you live in Maine right now?
Yes, we've just moved here about a year ago because our daughter and grandchildren and their dad, they all moved here, and they said, it's a beautiful place. Why don't you follow us? And they had come up here in the summers, and we had visited them in the summers, and we knew they were luring us up here.
Right.
So we said, well, if we can sell our house, we'll come. And so we sold our house.
What a great place to be to write stories, I would think.
Oh,
very atmospheric,
so
and you have some, you've only had probably one winter there so far, but I would think it lends itself well to storytelling.
Yes, it does. I think much like where you are on the West Coast, mm-hmm. there's something about these coastal regions very inviting to writers.
Yes, yeah. So can I ask you a little just about your process and what that's like for you? Are you somebody who sits down and this comes to you? I know the title came to you very organically. Do you outline? Do you just start writing and let the story take you?
Yes, the latter of what you said. I don't outline. I was one of those children in school who never could outline. But I prefer to just start with just an image. Usually I have an image of a person in a place or a situation, and then I just write very rapidly in order to find out what the story is. And it's very rough and loose, the first draft, and it because I keep it that way, it keeps any fear or self-criticism away. I just am having fun with that first draft, just writing to see what will happen, what are the possibilities. And then when that first draft is done, usually that takes about 3 months. When that first draft is done, then I go back and start looking at where the holes are and what it might need, and have I answered the big questions? Have I posed the questions? And I go over it and over it, and maybe do 3 or 4 really full drafts before I send it to my editor at HarperCollins. And she has a look at it and always has questions to raise. She's found some other spots maybe that aren't clear or need fleshing out. And so then I do another full draft responding to her comments, and that's usually it. That usually takes about a year for each book.
Yeah, it can be a lengthy process. And The Boy on the Porch, I think, came out in September. Are you working on something else right now?
Well, normally I would be. Normally by the time a book came out, I would be nearly finished with the next book. But I've interrupted that process because we moved this year.
Oh, right.
And that took all my creative energy. And so I haven't yet. I'm sort of just having fun spending time with the grandchildren and fixing up the house and doing the garden and all of that. So soon I will, though. Soon on the next. I have no idea right now, though, what it will be.
Well,
so
you're going to be...
comes to me.
You're going
to
be hanging a picture one day, and as you're hammering that nail in, you'll get an idea.
That's right.
Well, Sharon Creech, I want to thank you for being with us today. Newbery and Carnegie Medal winner and author of the latest book is called The Boy on the Porch, and it is a beautiful novel about finding love in surprising places. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Sharon?
Oh, just, you know, on this day, I say go outside and go for a hike. It's so beautiful. And then find a good book. Go into your local independent bookstore and find a good book and read it to a child. That would be my lovely thought to leave for you today.
There we go. And even though it's fogged in and raining here, I still went a long walk in the rain this morning and enjoyed it. So there we go.
Good. Oh, good.
Thanks so much for being with us. And listeners can find out more about Sharon at SharonCreek.com. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Places I go make me feel tongue-tied. And I can see how people look down there on the inside. Here's where the story ends.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Ahead of the talk radio curve, naturally. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'm pleased in this segment to have Dave Gardner joining us. He's the producer, director, and writer of the documentary Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth. Dave has been a professional director for over 30 years, directing documentaries and other award-winning projects for a long list of Fortune 500 corporate clients, and also for PBS. And he's also got an interesting background in some sidelines here. So let me bring him on and we'll find out a little bit more about that. Dave Gardner, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, your interesting little sidelines, of course, are not really sidelines. This is your passion and it's all about growth. But I read that you ran for Colorado Springs City Council in 2009. Tell us what your whole goal is in doing this kind of work.
Well, I guess I decided maybe sometime around 2002 that my mission in life was to make it okay to be against growth. I discovered that economic growth and population growth are not perpetually possible on a finite planet. They're unsustainable, and that it was time to make it okay to question those as our holy grail.
And so you didn't win that race when you ran for Colorado Springs, but you did get 43% of the vote. So a lot of people are thinking along the same lines with you.
Well, that surprised me. And, I ran a little bit as an experiment because I wasn't sure that the public was ready for my message, which was that growth created the problems we're facing, so it can't really be the solution. So it did. It surprised the heck out of me to get that kind of support, especially in a pretty conservative community like Colorado Springs.
Right, right. I was watching the film Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth. Tell us what drove you to make this documentary, because it takes a lot of work to put a documentary film together.
Oh, you're not kidding. even being a professional filmmaker, it was a surprise to me. Of course, I think what made it really hard work was that I was trying to raise money to fund the project while I was doing it, which they advise against, and now I understand why. So it took me about 6 years to make the film. But it really did become a passion for me to wake up, or at least give people the opportunity to wake up if they want to, and smell the coffee. I was observing that in my own community, we were trading away not just quality of life, but also environmental quality in this chase for economic growth and for growing the community. We're chasing population growth. We're competing with other cities. I would venture to say even Seattle. There are probably people in Seattle who are out there trying to win over new companies and the employees that would follow to move to Seattle because they believe that a city is either growing or it's dying. And it's just, when you carry that out to, over the next couple of hundred years, you realize that when we've filled up the planet already, it's just not possible. So we need a new prosperity strategy, and for some reason I took it upon myself to try to be the clarion call for that.
Right, and I should make it clear, you're not against total growth, but you are against sustainable growth. And you were so right on Seattle growing like crazy, because when I didn't realize until I had company a couple of weeks ago and I was driving them around, everywhere is under construction. Throwing buildings up left, right, and center against roads that are already jam-packed with traffic.
Yeah, and it's been interesting. In researching the film, I learned some just amazing things, like the fact that adding a lane to a freeway, what that actually does is that opens the door to more development, and that it's amazing how fast the freeway is just as clogged. You cannot build freeways fast enough to stay ahead of the growth. There was a guy named Al Bartlett who just recently passed away, who was a physics professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, who really kind of dedicated his life long before I did to waking people up to the fact that that growth is not sustainable. And you mentioned whether we're against all kinds of growth or not, and I guess what I would say is that the sum total of economic throughput, we need to find a way to stabilize that. There'll always be some parts of your economy that are growing. Hopefully it would be renewable energy and conservation oriented services would be growing, and that we would be shrinking dirty ways of generating electricity, but that the overall, at the end of the day, when you look at the GDP figure, if GDP is going up, that is really more a measure of how fast we're destroying our life support systems than it is of how healthy our economy is.
Right. And you said earlier that we live in a full world. And one of the quotes that kind of hit me was Herman Daly in the film Growthbusters. He was ecological economist and former senior economist for the World Bank. He says, in an empty world, it was a safe bet that growth makes us richer, but we no longer live in an empty world. The world is full. So what is the solution, Dave? We know what the problem is. What's the solution?
Well, it's interesting. When I started making the film, my goal was to try to convince the world that we needed to stop growing. But it turned out I didn't need to do that. It turned out that we are actually living through the end of growth right now, whether we like it or not. Growth is coming to an end. The planet is pushing back. It just won't allow us to continue to grow the scale of the human enterprise, which is really the product of how many of us there are and how we're behaving, or our size of our economy. It's just not going to happen. And peak oil is one of the big factors there. We just don't have an endless supply of cheap energy to keep up this 200-year binge that we've been on. So growth is coming to an end. So the solutions that we need to be looking for are just, what are the elegant ways we can embrace the end of growth instead of fighting it and wasting a lot of time and resources trying to return to those thrilling years of the gravy years of the last century. The sooner we figure out that it's a new century, and we're not going to repeat the way we did things last century. Let's get back in touch with what progress really means. Does it really mean more of everything this year than last year? Do we really have to be earning more money? Do we really have to have bigger houses? Do we have to have nicer cars? Or would we like to maybe relax a little bit and have more quality time with the people we love?
I heard a report this morning from Gallup, and they said apparently that they predict Black Friday shopping will be down this year from $789 per person to $700. So even if it is down this year, it's not going to go down too much. And an interesting thing in the film, another interesting quote that I picked up on was that we're no longer, quote, citizens. We are always called consumers.
Oh, that is really one of my pet peeves. And the role of the media, you got to blame the media a lot for that. I don't like to blame a lot of people, but that's one of the roles of the media, is that, that's just the automatic term that they use when they're just trying to describe people. We're
right.
consumers.
Right.
And, I'm trying to convince people it's time to raise the window, stick your head out and shout, I am not a consumer. I'm a human being. We've got to get that consumption gene out of our system. And in fact, that's why Black Friday is a really big event to me, because if we can if we really do start participating less and less in that shopping frenzy, then the system has no choice but to evolve. We will force the system to change.
Right. And it's not just Black Friday anymore. I mean, many stores are opening Thursday, a whole new list of stores announced this year, and I'm not going to name them because I don't want to contribute to it, but a whole list of stores added their names to the list of stores that will be opening this, on the Thursday, which would be Thanksgiving Day. I have issues with that on many levels, because everybody deserves a day off a year, and surely we can go one day without buying anything, right?
Yes, it really is a sad statement about just what a consumerist culture we live in today.
Mm. So tell us a little bit more about the film, because I know you have free screenings, you're offering a free screening, and what's your big call to action here?
Well, first of all, we really do want to encourage people to stay away from the malls on Black Friday. It's largely symbolic, but that's it's the first step. And I think if you stay home and you have some quality family time, play some games, and you watch this free worldwide screening of the Growthbusters documentary that we're offering, the one thing that it will do is it'll stimulate some conversation, because it does kind of shake up everything that we thought we knew about the way the world works. And if once your family starts, having that conversation about, well, gosh, why do we all go shopping, and why do we not think about the fact that every time we buy a product, somebody had to mine something, they had to transport something, consumed a lot of energy, emitted a lot of carbon dioxide, and something ends up in the landfill before it's done. We had that conversation in my family several years ago, largely because I decided to be a starving artist and make a documentary, and so
right.
I couldn't afford to be a super consumer anymore.
Right.
It was really a great transition for me. But my family has had a lot of fun coming up with much less consumptive ways to still honor that holiday gift-giving tradition. And it turns out that when you don't race to the mall to get something on sale, and you have to be more creative about finding a way to show somebody your love, it connects you at a much deeper level. And we have a lot of fun re-gifting white elephant items and giving the gift of time to each other. It's a lot more fun.
And celebrating Thanksgiving, on more traditional terms and for what it's supposed to be all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We tend to forget, especially, now that the stores are open on Thanksgiving Day, it does erode what that holiday means.
Right. Well, I said to you before we went live on air, I think we might be preaching to the choir here, Dave. And so I'm going to ask you a question that somebody asked me a couple of years ago, actually, when I was pitching on a project. And and it was a commercial corporate project, but he said to me, all he wanted to do was talk about one of the documentary film projects I'd worked on. And he said, why, tell me why, when I've worked a 60, 70 hour week, I should come home tired. I've got kids I need to attend to. I have a wife I need to attend to. Tell me why I should care, why I should plug in.
That is such a great opening. That's exactly why you should care. We, you know, we have become slaves to the system. And it's a lot of it's about keeping up with the Joneses. We, you know, we're, most of us are leveraged to the hilt. Why? Because we began to define ourselves by our possessions. We looked at our neighbors and the people that we admired. If they had a certain size house, a 3 or 4 car garage, whatever it is, we began to define our own self-worth based on those material acquisitions. And so we've ended up giving up so much of our lives. We work through lunch, we work long days, we're in long commutes, many of us, so that we can live in, and afford to live in a McMansion way out in the suburbs. And you don't ever get that time back. You know, you can't, you know, you have all these possessions, and at the end of the day, when you're on your deathbed, no one ever says, boy, I wish I had bought, you know, a newer Lexus last year, or I wish I'd spent more time at the office. I know that's a cliche, but just sitting back and enjoying the people you love, knowing them better, sitting on the porch and watching a thunderstorm roll in, those are the kind of things that really are a lot more meaningful than whether you have the latest iPhone.
Right.
So I'm trying to help people recognize that, wow, the system isn't delivering the good life anymore. So why don't we all step off that treadmill and relax a bit? And it's going to be good for us, and it's going to be good for the planet.
Right. And you are offering, as I said, a free screening link to anyone who registers on your website. The website is growthbusters.org. Is that correct? That's correct. Right?
Yes, there's a free Black Friday screening button right under the big picture on the homepage. And you do need to register so that we can send you the link. But the screening is absolutely free. And there'll be a screening on Black Friday at 5 p.m. Pacific time in the U.S., I believe. But then we're also going to run the film again on Saturday because in many parts of the world, Saturday is really the day that a lot of the holiday shopping kicks
right,
off.
Right. Well, Dave Gardner, you're doing great work out there, and I hope this makes a little dent. even just a little dent helps, right?
We do what we can, and thanks for helping us make that dent.
Sure. And again, Dave Gardner, writer, producer, and director of Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth. And you can find out more at growthbusters.org. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Rivina Sharma. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love? An exercise buddy or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Canine and Feline Caviar, we cover the world of animals. This week, November 24th, it's Shelter Rescue Sanctuary and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll talk with Betsy at Mollywood Avian Sanctuary in Bellingham and Bob at Macaw Rescue and Sanctuary in Carnation. We'll also talk with Suzette at Allbreed Equine Rescue in Marysville, and we'll have it something new in our feature segment. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 11.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Time for something different. Time for Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Rivian Sharma. She's a writer and community organizer. She holds degrees in philosophy, comparative literature, social work, and education. And her writing has appeared in publications such as Ms., Glamour, and the New York Times. She has a very strong spiritual belief, which she draws from many sources, Eastern and Western religions, native traditions, Sufis and shamans, elders and children. And her new book is called Recipes for a Sacred Life, True Stories and a Few Miracles. Rivian Sharma, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Vicki. I'm so happy to be with you today. Thank you.
We're pleased to have you here. And I want to begin with this because you say that your mom, when you got married at the age of 22, you were handed a book of handwritten recipes by your mother. But nobody gave you the recipe for a good marriage or a good life. So is that why you wrote this book?
Well, I think... Yes, I think that's what started it. You know, I mean, not only she didn't give me recipes for a good life, but she only gave me two cooking recipes, chicken and roast beef. So I knew something was missing from the start. And then life turned out to be much harder than I had been prepared for. And my first marriage did end in divorce. And all my life, I've kind of been a seeker. It's just been my way. And I started thinking, you know, there's got to be some recipes out there. Some, you know, if you do this, you get that. If you want to feel happy, if you want to find your purpose, this is what you do. So I was always looking. And then kind of a lot of magical events evolved where I took a quiz one night, how to find your highest purpose. And I found out it was to live a sacred life. And it was soon after that that an editor called me and asked me to write an article on how to create a sacred space in your home. And I thought, wow, this is strange. And I was, you know, starting to write the article in my mind one day, and I heard a voice say to me very clearly, Rivi, write a book, how to create a sacred life. So it was, you know, the culmination of finding my purpose, but not really knowing yet what that meant, a sacred life. But then after this happened and I made the commitment and the commitment to write the book, all these people and experiences started coming into my life. And each one, you know, held a lesson or an aspect of sacred living. And I'm a storyteller, so it all comes out as stories that, you know, these are the most inspiring stories from my life.
Right. And you've done so many things. I mean, let me just share a little bit with our listeners. You've been a teacher, social worker in Harlem, a campaign manager in Boulder, a college instructor in Queens, even a tarot reader at Macy's on Halloween. You've also founded a couple or been co-founder of a couple of groups, including an advocacy group in New York City for better bicycling, walking, and mass transit. And this all they say, despite your aversion to change, you don't
right.
like change. You sound like quite a change maker to me.
Well, I also have an aversion to boredom. So,
yeah. When you went, you said you went through some difficult times and mm-hmm. your first marriage ended in divorce. And I heard that when you, after the divorce, you decided to change your name and choose your own name. Tell us why you did that and what it means.
Interesting. Well, it was some years after my divorce because I had found a man that I loved and we were going to get married. And I realized I wasn't going to keep the name of my first husband, but I didn't have any feelings of going back to my, you know, birth name. And it, my new husband is English, and Rivi Wilcoxon just sounded a little wrong to me. And then Rivi is from Rivka. It's a Hebrew word, and it means bound to. It's from the Bible, Rebecca. And I never liked that I was bound to something, but someone had once said, think of it as being bound to your soul. And neshama in Hebrew means soul. So I legally changed my name, you know, to Rivi Neshama, that I'm bound to my spirit, bound to my soul. And it was very powerful legal proceeding, and I dressed all in white, and one of my good friends came and took pictures, and we had flowers, and it's something, you know, I'd recommend people do it if they ever feel, you know, not in sync with the name they have, that
right.
It's worth doing
right.
To pick a name that has, you know, deep meaning to you.
Yeah, it's very symbolic. Every story in the book is from your life. It's a story from your life or people that you've been connected mm-hmm. to, friends, family, teachers, strangers even. And I heard that I listened to a podcast that you had done, and interesting on there, because you said that you didn't write these stories, you edited them. They came to you because you're a good editor. So tell us about that whole process, because as a writer myself, of course, I'm always interested in this.
Well, I used to be a writer, you know, as you said before, you know, I wrote for magazines, and then I went much more into community organizing. But I was also, I'm a good editor, I have to say. So I edited for Vela News Magazine for 10 years, and then I had my own freelance business. And I like to edit. It's like doing puzzles, you know, finding the right word. And with the stories, when I said after I made that vow to, you know, live a sacred life, to write a book, I felt the stories came to me. They were, there's sometimes in my life when writing has just sort of like dropped down from heaven. It's an inspiration. I'm just, and like all of a sudden, different pieces of the puzzle come together. And I think, whoa, that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I would write it down. It just was given to me. But then, being an editor, I might edit it like 50 times until it feels musical and the words are just right and it uplifts people and it has a good ending and a good beginning. And so I was the editor working with inspiration.
Interesting. And of course, you know, good writing is rewriting. So
yes.
One of the stories in the book, you break it down into different segments, and the first segment, if you will, part one, is about basic ingredients. And one of the stories you share in there is tea and compassion. And I wanted to talk a little about that, because when I was growing up, you know, it didn't matter what was going on in your day, whether you're having a good day, a bad day. If you stopped by and visited someone, first thing they do is put the kettle on, make a cup of tea, and you sit down and, you know, have your cup of tea. And
mm-hmm.
when I was, you know, younger and I was a teenager, I was like, why does everybody sit around drinking cups of tea? As I've grown older, I appreciate those cups of tea because they have some significance, as I'm sure you'll appreciate being married to a British man.
Right.
But tell us a little bit about the story in the book that's called Tea and Compassion. And
mm-hmm.
tell us in your own words, if you would.
Okay. I should say that also there's another story that comes, I think, right before or right after that, my mother-in-law's bedroom.
Yes, yeah.
Which takes place in England, and where she says, I talk about the routine and the calmness of it and the order and how wonderful it felt that every day at 4 when we visit her, she'd say, would you like some tea, dear? And we'd have our tea before we'd have dinner and Scrabble. And happy families, that wonderful card game. But tea and compassion is actually about a Sufi teacher that I had, Halil Baba, and that we met sometimes in New York at the apartment of another person who was in the Sufi order I had joined. And we would sit on the floor on big pillows, very Turkish and, you know, different, a little bit in England, you know, sitting on the floor,
mm-hmm.
and we'd eat vine leaves stuffed with rice and nuts and beautiful brass tray and sit back on the velvet pillows, and then we'd sip tea and talk, you know. And the story is about it's tea and compassion. It was a time I learned from this experience that day what compassion is, how big it is, and how to have it for myself and how to have it for others. And the Sufis, they teach through stories, so it's a story within a story. When my teacher tells a little story about compassion, because I had just told him I just had a fight with my husband, so I felt like a pure fake, you know, sitting there with the spiritual teacher writing this sacred book. And here I had just done the same bad thing I often do with my husband. And if you want, I could tell you the little parable he told.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Because he was saying how, you know, I said, I feel so bad because I say I'm sorry, but, you know, I know I'm going to do it again. And he said, well, you know, it's like parents, when the children say they're sorry, the parents know they'll do it again, but they see that the child really, their heart's full and they want to, they're sorry. And so they forgive the children even though they're doing it again. And Halil Baba said, Allah is the same way, that he sees our remorse and good heart and loves us and is happy, even knowing we'll likely do the very thing again. Then he told us a parable, which is how Sufis teach, through stories and fables from their oral tradition. There is a vast deep ocean, he said, and on that ocean there's a tiny island. And on that island there's a parrot sitting in a tree. And on the beak of the parrot there's a tiny speck of dirt. Can you see that? Halil Baba asked, his brown eyes shining. Well, that tiny speck of dirt is our sins. But the vast deep ocean is Allah's compassion. I felt my heart open to the day, to myself, to compassion. Then I smiled at John. He smiled back at me. And we both knew, most likely, I'd do that very thing again.
But now you'll have the understanding of compassion. And I wondered when I read that, can we really have compassion for others if we don't have it for ourselves?
Right. I don't think so. I think that's what so many teachings share, you know, telling us that it has to start love for yourself, compassion for yourself, forgiveness of yourself. Then you can forgive others, have compassion, and have love. So, but it works both ways, too. I think when you forgive someone else, it helps you forgive yourself. So it's a circle.
Right. There's another segment in the book called A Nature Recipe from Frank Lloyd Wright, and he writes, study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, it will never fail you. And I'm somebody who I think would get my spiritual practice comes from nature, if you will. And you say that in the first story there, study nature, that you were in one of your many midlife transitions, and for someone who doesn't like change, and I decided to become a teacher for inner city kids. So you enrolled at Bank Street College, where you were taught to study nature the way we'd teach our students. How do you teach your students to study nature?
Not by reading, but observing and reflecting, watching something as it grows or changes. And the professor had us pick something, and I picked the moon. So I was living in Manhattan then, so every day I'd go with my sketch pad and I'd go to the same place and watch where the moon would be at different times of the day. And sometimes I'd get so excited, and I'd go, you know, my husband John was with me, and I'd go, look, and all the New Yorkers around us, they were thinking, what's happening? And we're just pointing at the moon. It's hard to find sometimes, especially in a daytime sky. I think before I did that, I wasn't even aware that you can see the moon in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
No, and now I'm very conscious of it.
Yeah, I see it a lot because I walk my dog, but and I'm always looking up and down and around.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's about, really, when you're out in nature, is to look up and down and around. So many people look down at the floor. Well, I would love to talk to you for another hour about the stories in your book, but we're right at the end of our show today. So I want to let listeners know they can find out more about you and your work at rivyshanama.com. That's RIVYNESHAMA.com. And Rivi, I want to thank you for being with us today. Loved your book.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to be with you. And I hope people, they can check the book out on Amazon. Just put in Rivi, And it's a great holiday gift book. And
super.
Have a good holiday.
Thank you. And the book, again, is called Recipes for a Sacred Life, True Stories and a Few Miracles. RivenaSharma.com is where you can find out more information. And I want to thank you for being with us today. We are right at the end of our show, so I have to rush out of here. But I just want to say live well, live strong. And I will see you next week. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.